Richard Blanco is one of the most beloved and influential poets and storytellers writing today. He was born in Madrid in 1968 and immigrated as an infant with his Cuban family to the United States. He was raised and educated in Miami, earned a BS in civil engineering and an MFA in creative writing from Florida International University. His books are City of 100 Fires, Directions to the Beach of the Dead, Looking for the Gulf Motel, One Today, Boston Strong, and his latest book, which is a memoir, The Prince of Los Cocuyos, A Miami Childhood. Richard Blanco, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Hi, great to be here.
Congratulations on this new book, The Prince of Los Cocuyos. Just let me start off with my first impression of when I started reading this book. I immediately slid into the story. I mean, you know, that whole John Gardner vivid and continuous dream phenomenon where you forget you're reading and you're actually there. That's how this book works for me. I mean, immediately I was there watching the movie of your childhood. And I imagine that the same experience might have happened to you as you were writing your in front of your word processor or whatever you write on, and suddenly you kind of transformed back into your childhood. Did you discover new things about your memory, about your past when you entered into the landscape?
Yeah, certainly. I think that's part of the process. You know, when you sit down to write a memoir, you're like, your first thought is, but nothing happened. Or like this idea. And as you sort of start digging and digging a little bit further and trying to unravel or unpack those memories, you start realizing all these other things that you remember and all this periphery information that makes it into each chapter, into each episode. And certainly that was true. I mean, one of the things I discovered was in writing this book is sort of the intersection, and one of the things that became an obsession in the book is sort of the intersection of, you know, sexuality, sexual identity, artistic identity, cultural identity, and all these things that were there from sort of childhood, you know, how all these things sort of collided and intersected and sort of make for a unique individual, you know, all these forces that shape us. And that really was what took over in the book and something I wanted to investigate, my grandmother being sort of the poster child of that investigation, which a woman who was very xenophobic and homophobic, so anything that was culturally odd was also considered queer. So all these intersections and layers of things. And I certainly learned a lot, especially in regard to her, as I wrote in the acknowledgments. You know, it allowed me, writing the book allowed me to hate her, understand her, forgive her, and love her. So.
Yeah, and you know, I couldn't help but think as I submerged into this world, that scene from Our Town by Thornton Wilder, where Emily, who is dead, is given the permission to go back and relive her life, but it's so painful for her because she wants to say stuff that she could have said but didn't say, and she has to just essentially repeat what happens. And I imagine going back into your past, there might have been moments that were a little painful.
And funny.
Yeah, there's a lot of humor in this.
You can't have Cuban or have Cuban American sort of sensibility of life, which is always this tragic comic sense to everything. But yeah, there were moments, you know, where I had to relive a lot of the stuff with my grandmother, especially, and also the experience the pain of others. I'm thinking about my mother. I really got to know my mother in another way that I didn't in the poetry. You know, her sense of loss and loneliness. Having to leave her entire family in Cuba, and really connected with her in the memoir in a different way. And that was actually part of, you know, the motivation of writing the memoir. It's almost like another way of thinking, whereas the poetry, and poetry will always be in my heart and part of who I am. But I was just curious what the process, you know, when I first started this project, just curious about what that writing process in prose and memoir would do for me. And I realized that the unpacking of those stories, that there were things in poetry that I couldn't, that the genre doesn't accommodate, that I couldn't do. I couldn't, you know, really delve into characters. I couldn't, I mean, I can in another way, and then probably a much more compact and perhaps emotionally concentrated way. But certainly unpacking those, that poetry in this prose really sort of opened up different dimensions of my character and also of the lives and the people around me.
We're talking to Richard Blanco, whose new book, The Prince of Los Cocuyos, just came out. It's a memoir. When I read this book, when I first actually picked it up, thinking, well, this is a memoir written by a poet, I expected a lot of attention to be drawn to the language. And I was really surprised that your book isn't doing that. It's not making me step back and say, oh, well, that language is so beautiful. It works in a more organic way. The language just completely, at times, disappears. Did you find it hard to fight against the lyricism and just, you know, make it as straightforward as it is?
Yeah, I think that was part of the challenge. And part of the challenge maybe earlier on, because, of course, there were other drafts and other projects that I had sort of delved into, including writing essays and stuff. Mm-hmm. And a couple of key things that changed the way I approached. One of my friend Brian Leung said that he found it interesting that in poetry, the aim of the author is to be as present and as alive as possible in every word and syllable.
Yeah.
And that in prose, and he's a fiction writer in particular, that the idea is that the author needs to step away and let the characters live on the page without his or her sort of overbearing self on top of them. And I kept that in mind. And the way the book is sort of put together is almost each chapter just deals with my relationship with a main character in my life, my grandmother, my mother, my grandfather, my brother, and of course everybody else in there in the mix, and also the grocery store, and the city, which are both these inanimate characters that take on a life for me in the book. And it was about stepping back a little and just sort of narrating the stories and the relationships and how, you know, they affected me, but in a more tangential way, because the tendency in writing memoirs to over edit or editorialize and to stick yourself in there all the time.
Yeah.
Here's this narrative, and by the way, this is what I think about it. Well, just let the narrative live. You don't have to really comment that much about it.
That's a good point, because the language doesn't draw attention to itself, but there are also not these musings about culture or about immigrants or about anything like that. You just present the thing in itself, and we're able to enter it and process it the way we want to, and that's quite an achievement. It's also a very funny book. I mean, laugh out loud funny. Especially the parts about the food. The very first chapter is called The First Real Thanksgiving, phonetically how I guess your family pronounced Thanksgiving. They say Thanksgiving. And it's a hilarious chapter. It has a lot to do with food and the difference between American food and Cuban food, and the difference between American grocery stores and between Cuban grocery stores. And it's just hilarious. Can you tell us a little bit about the foods that were important to you when you were a child, wanting to experience the American way of life?
Yeah, sure. I mean, food is just a cultural signifier for so many things. I still, the first thing I do when I get to Miami is, right in the airport, I start having pastelitos and coffee before I even exit the gate. And the same happens, I think, for American foods. Like, I still have to have a box of Cheez-Its every now and then. I guess where that really comes from, and the food being a part of it, a big part of it, of course, in any culture. But growing up in Miami, which is a lot of what the book is sort of discussing, you know, it was like growing up between two imaginary worlds. And one was the 1950s and 60s Cuba of my parents and grandparents and the community, this place that I was from, supposedly, but had never been to. And because Miami was so sort of culturally insular and so very Cuban, America felt like this other place. And so America felt like somewhere north of the county line. And I contextualized a lot of what I thought America or what I thought real being a real American meant by, number one, television, you know, the Brady Bunch and all those sitcoms and old 60s and 70s shows. And then food, you know, because this was something that was exotic. If you really think about it, you know, the tables were turned. I had arroz con pollo every week, and I had, you know, all these other Cuban foods, but I wanted
Easy cheese.
And I wanted, you know, it was the forbidden, the exotic.
Yeah.
And so that first chapter is all about sort of the story of how we get to, through fate and partly through my plotting and partly through my grandmother's frugalness, we end up going to Winn-Dixie chasing after after Whole Friars chickens on special. And I get to throw in a few things into the grocery cart and finally have a real Thanksgiving.
Yeah, that was a lovely scene when the grandmother gets all those chickens because they're such a great price and doesn't realize or doesn't learn until she gets to the cashier that you can only have two per person.
Yeah, limit two per customer. And then the other counter current is sort of, while I'm chasing after this sort of mythic America, you know, little Ricky, as I call myself in the book, is also sort of, there's a countercurrent to that, which is he's also discovering his heritage and, mm-hmm. and sort of slowly falling in love with his birthright, with his cultural background, which initially every child always rejects whatever their parents represent, right? So there's not this sense that we grow up, you know, oh, I love being a little Cuban kid and, you know, eating pork on Thanksgiving. The fact is that anything that, you know, your parents do is immediate grounds for rejection, like dancing salsa, that's tacky, you know, right. You know, all this stuff. So the book is really about, you know, growing to realize the truth of both these cultures and demystify them. And the grocery store, which is the name of where the book is named after, which is El Cocuyito, which is basically a firefly, is where sort of is the finishing school of little Ricky, where he really learns, you know, later in his adolescent years about, through the customers and employees and the relatives that work in the store that really sort of mentor him. And it's sort of the proverbial village, hence the prince of Los Cucuyos, but the proverbial village that sort of, you know, mentors him into the ways of being Cuban, so to speak.
I don't know if Easy Cheese is still around, but I imagine Cheese Whiz, right?
Yes, it certainly is. And there's all sorts of different flavors now, too.
Oh, no. Nacho flavor and pizza flavor.
I've had them all.
Yeah, and that's a wonderful scene. The first time the grandmother goes into Winn-Dixie, which is a gringo grocery store, she's very intimidated. She's very nervous. But the first thing that you do is go for the Easy Cheese. And I love that scene where, you know, he puts a little bit on her finger and she tastes it. She goes, mmm. And then she says, okay, let's get it. But put that can back and get a new one.
You never take the one in the front.
Yeah, and then she always says, every time she tries a new food, she says, ¿Cómo inventan los americanos?
Yeah, that was a very big saying amongst the family in general. But yeah, ¿Cómo inventan los americanos? Because to them, it was, all these novelties were like these, you know, the American ingenuity, cheese in a can. Like,
and then so instant mashed potatoes.
My grandmother to seeing another side of America, which, you know, or Americana, that you don't, you know, living in a tight-knit, close-knit community like that, that you don't really get access to. And so she, in a way, is also sort of being, demystifying her own sense of America. Yeah,
she's going with it. She was amazed by the instant mashed potatoes. That's a fantastic scene.
And cubaroni.
Yes, I was just about to say that. You buy macaroni and cheese, and we all remember those blue and white Kraft boxes of macaroni and cheese, and which when we were kids tasted great, but which now probably don't taste as great. And so she took it, but then she started adding, what would she add, like garlic and
chorizo and peppers and all that.
And she called it cubaroni.
That way.
You seem to be the one in the family who had the duty of translating from English to Spanish, not only the recipes, but the whole idea of Thanksgiving or whenever your grandmother needed somebody to translate. And I'm wondering how you think that affected your sense of music and sound and language by having to express things in two languages.
Well, that's interesting that you noted that. Because in some ways, I was the first person to learn English in the family. As my brother was older, and sort of it took him a little bit longer, and I arrived here when I was 45 days old, and probably by 2 years old, I was already in daycare. So I picked up English rather quickly, and I have been serving as a translator in many contexts since I remember, since 3 years old or so, my parents asked, how do you say this, how do you say that in English? You know, people always ask me, what was your first language? And I don't have a first language. I don't remember a time when I didn't know two languages.
Oh, I like that answer. That's awesome.
And I think it's just two ways of thinking about the world. I mean, obviously, of interpreting the world. And I obviously switch back and forth, as you see in the book, both in terms of the dialogue and others' characters speak. But as far as I think it makes it into perhaps a little bit more into my poetry, but also I think in the prose, the sense of the texture of the language, I've been told, you know, I'm sometimes one is the worst sort of deciphering one's own inclinations in the work, but I've been told that a lot of sort of the lushness and the sort of the longer sentences and this sort of Flaubert kind of, you know, mm-hmm. embellishment in the language comes from my sensibility in Spanish, which is, I think, a little more colorful, a little bit more. That language can hold a lot more in terms of, or accept a lot more in terms of expression, and I think that makes it in there. I think that's part of that sometimes mostly intangible quality sometimes that you read and that makes people's work, their work, their signature.
Yeah, and I think that when we're thinking in two languages, I really like what you said, that you didn't have a first language. First time I've heard somebody express it that way, but it makes a lot of sense. But when you hear a word in English or you translate it to Spanish or vice versa, or you hear similarities, you're able to make connections linguistically that monolingual people just can't make. And so I imagine that really might have been partially responsible for your love of language.
And the prosa was especially interesting because I've never had to write that much dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And poetry, you know, it's more summary, or rather I'm speaking about what people say. In the memoir, actually, I had to write dialogue, and it was really interesting because in my ear, my parents, my grandparents didn't speak English to me. I mean, they spoke English only when they needed to, and even when they did, it was heavily accented. So in investigating how they spoke, how they would, it was just really a neat sort of exercise, and how they sounded to me in English, and I tried to work out different ways in which that worked best. One was to write the sort of very accented, phonetically sort of accented speech, and they sounded like buffoons, you know, like they sounded like, "I just let's go to the beach," you know.
Right.
They sounded like you know, some cartoon character, like what's that little mouse that's always running around?
Speedy Gonzalez.
Speedy Gonzalez. Yeah, it sounded like Speedy Gonzalez, and I was like, "No, we're not having this."
Yeah.
I mean, it sounded so stereotypic. And then the other thing was what I decided on eventually was just putting in Spanish words that were key, and thinking about how those words can in context create sort of an understanding and a sensibility of both languages, which is kind of how it happens in my head, right? Like I my parents would speak to me in Spanish, but then my ear, you know, not my ear, but my mind would translate into English and vice versa. And so it's always happening. Two languages are happening at the same time. And I'll code switch, as they say, you know, there's nothing like cussing in Spanish, you know.
That's right.
And there's nothing like terms of endearment in Spanish.
Cussing and prayer in Spanish are is the best language to do those things.
Yeah.
One of the ways that makes me really appreciate the prose in this is how sometimes if the grandmother says something in Spanish, you'll immediately translate it into English, and other times you won't. And that tells me that you're not following a formula, but you're just following the rhythm. And I really appreciate that, because I know sometimes writers feel intense pressure to have to translate absolutely everything.
Yeah, no, I figured I'd try to set it up syntactically in context, but there's really sort of interesting things like happen. For example, like dime, right? Like dime, tell me, right? Like my mother would always say, "Dime," you know, "tell me." And but when you begin a sentence like that, even if you italicize it, the reader will read "dime."
Yeah, right.
So I had to sort of play with the syntax and words like that, or like "dale, go to the store." But when it's spelled out in English, it spells "Dale."
Yeah,
Dale,
exactly.
Go to the store.
I had to make that choice once when I was writing about eating mole. If you don't say mole, you're going to be eating mole.
That's true. I hadn't thought about that. Right. And even if you italicize it, sometimes the placing, where you place the word in the syntactical context can, I think Sandra Cisneros always uses a great example of pie or pie, you know?
Right.
that pie is, you know, pie in Spanish. And she always says something like, are we having pumpkin feet or pumpkin pie?
and that happens to the family, your family in Thanksgiving. They don't want to eat the pie. They don't want to eat the feet.
Yeah, it's always like because they're just looking, you know, they're reading language, even though English,
right.
they're trying to understand it in Spanish with their Spanish minds. And so when I heard Sandra say that, I was like, are we related? Because it seemed like, you know, I think it's, you know, it's obviously cross-culture. It's not just Cubans. It's probably Latinos. Although the United States have that – that going on in their heads. And,
right.
and I think I, you know, just always mixing two languages in some ways is how I exist. And sometimes in between, or like my mother says now in her older age, she says, I'm forgetting Spanish and I don't know English.
That's fantastic.
Just living in this sort of there comes a point where the languages cancel out each other and you're just, your brain is tired.
it reminds me of the old Chicano term, rascuache. What is rascuache? Someone who has an accent in both languages.
Right, exactly.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. It's a fantastic book, and I'd like to invite listeners to go to your webpage. It's an incredibly beautiful page, richard-blanco.com, and they can learn a little bit more about you. Thank you for joining us. I wish you the best of luck on this book. It's a fantastic read.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Glad you enjoyed it.